You are listening to the Frilla Bros Tech Podcast, episode 169, a cash flow positive episode as a service with an exit strategy.
Episode 169 of the Furlow Bros Tech Podcast. Today is December the 20th, 2014. I'm Matthew Dean Furlow, and this is my orc-slaying brother, James Furlow.
Oh, man. I saw that movie last night.
Yeah.
Epic!
It was pretty epic, wasn't it?
Yeah. I don't think I'm going to give any spoilers if I say this, but it reminded me a lot of Rocky III, where it was like, let's just make a movie about a fight. No storyline. Yeah. Let's just fight. Or another way I thought about it was, it's not a spoiler alert. It's okay. Jesse's like yelling at me for giving away spoiler alerts. I think everyone knows what they're in for. And then,
It's called the Battle of Five Armies. I mean,
it's called the Battle of Five Armies. What do you think happens? I mean, this isn't Twilight where it doesn't actually happen, okay? Come on.
That is the worst, by the way. That is the worst.
I just threw my hands in the air in the theater. I was like, really? I should have just got up and walked out at that moment.
What bothered me so much was how excited all the other 13 to 17-year-old girls in the audience, like how excited they were about that ending. Like, oh my god, they didn't die. Yay! I was like, it took away all the emotional impact. There was nothing good about that. Are you kidding me?
It was horrible.
I was on the verge of thinking this was a decent movie.
I know. And then the other thing I had too was like it reminded me of the Total War video game series, where especially in Realm Total War, you could create these custom battles where it's like, oh, let's bring 8 things onto the map and see what happens.
Yeah.
And you're like, sweet. That's what it was. But it's still good. I mean, it clearly is a trilogy, right? You can tell that it's a singular story, and you need to watch all 3 of them together, because it's not even close to a standalone movie.
Yeah, I feel like Return of the King and Fellowship definitely can be pretty self-contained. You know, there's a lot of just understanding the emotional gravity of the characters in Return of the Kings, you need to see the other 2 movies. But to understand the basics of what's going on, like, and who the characters are, hey, it's pretty straightforward. Like, okay, there's a couple of short guys that are trying to destroy some piece of jewelry, or a couple of normal-sized guys that are, like, kings or former kings of this kingdom, and they're trying to protect it from the ugly... And I can tell those are the bad guys because they're ugly, you know, like...
Yeah.
It's pretty straightforward, whereas this one, it would be pretty hard to understand any of the conflicts without... Which is fine, like, honestly, like...
Oh, yeah, I'm okay with that.
You know, I'm glad they changed the title from There and Back Again. A Hobbit's There. No, wait, was that the first one? What's the first one called?
I don't know.
I know they changed the title. Originally, it was like, the second one was The Desolation of Smaug, and everyone was like, okay, cool, Smaug's going to be in that one. And then this one, it was like, they changed the title right before they released it so that it didn't sound so wimpy, which I was glad. But that was fun. It was good.
It was good. I recommend, if you haven't seen the other 2 movies, watch them first. That's critical, in my opinion. And if it's been, say, like, a year... you might want a refresher.
Yeah, if you got the time. So James is a little off topic, but one thing that I really like is round numbers. I'm weird like that, and we're coming up on our 170th episode. And so
I know,
this is my question.
Crazy.
Technically, usually it's our New Year's Eve episode that we do all of our retrospective /
predictive
prospective. Predictive.
Okay, that works.
Episode. And it's like a 7-hour episode or something like that. I'm not exactly sure. I can't remember exactly what it is, but I know what it felt like.
It's at least a 2-hour of crowing about how awesome we are.
Exactly. But do we want to do that for our 170th, a round number, or do we want to do it for our 171st, which is technically in the new year?
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know.
From a prep standpoint, it's probably easier to wait.
That's true. I gotta say, this the nice part about this time of the year is that all of my favorite radio shows and podcasts go on vacation, unlike us, because we care about our audience, and so there's actually time for me to. There's nothing else to listen to, so I'll be listening to myself from last year, which always seems a little bit vain, but enjoyable. I don't know. What do you think? We don't have to decide right this instant.
Let's not decide right now.
Okay. Well, you know what? Instead of talking about that, James, you know what we're going to talk about this week?
What?
Like every week. We'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, we mean the soap opera of corporations, dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and, of course, the technology they are developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a disclosure he's got to throw our way so he doesn't get fired in the new year.
Yeah. I work for HP, but I do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions.
Ah, good to know. So when you make fun of HP, it's cool. When I make fun of HP, it's cool. Unless we know HP is listening, and then we'll softball a little bit. If you want to follow us throughout the week, we've got all sorts of what are those things called? Social network places you can go to check us out, see what we're doing. See the concerts and the Christmas festivities and the candy canes and the eggnogs and the lasagna makings and the whatnot of that are normally associated with this time of the year. You could do that. Go
lasagna?
To what?
Lasagna?
Yeah, I'm making lasagna with the rest of the cousins for New Year's Eve, and it's what I'm doing this year. I don't know about
that's
you.
That's right. That's like it's become a thing.
Yeah. It was so funny because, like, normally it's we go and get, like, Stouffer's from – somebody goes and gets, like, Stouffer's from Safeway and, like, you just throw it in the oven. And one of the cousins was like, that's really lame. Like, why do we do that? Lasagna is really easy to make. Let's just make lasagna.
You know what doesn't work? Lasagna in a crock pot.
Oh.
I tried it once. I had a recipe for it, and I was like, oh, this is awesome. I love lasagna. Crock pots are easy. Let's do it. And it's an interesting concept because you just, like, you literally take the hard noodles, you know, kind of break them up and you layer them in. You know, you put your sauce, you know, your spaghetti sauce, and cheese, and whatever other you want, and the hard ones in there, and you put it in. The issue is that it just turns everything to mush.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. It's, you know, it still tastes like, you're like, this is lasagna. It tastes like lasagna. Does not feel like lasagna. This is
it has the consistency of thick sauce. Yeah. That is the one problem with crock pots.
They're still good.
They're not perfect. Yeah, it's true. So, but if you want to follow us, go to Instagram because let's face it, that's where everybody is now. It's the new cool social network on the map. I'm next Wiggin 4, NextWiggin 4. Or if you're a loser and still on Twitter, go to Twitter, where I am @MatthewDFurlow. Those are your two good options.
You see, there was a new study that said popularity among teens for Facebook has dropped from 94% to 88%.
Oh my goodness!
So don't look for me there, because apparently that's not cool anymore. But I am also on Instagram. Under my name, James Furlow. I am also on Twitter, under my name, @JamesFurlow. I'm also on the regular internet, @JamesFurlow.com.
You're far better at branding than I am.
Yes.
It's just... I obviously don't take this thing seriously enough.
It's cool.
I can't even come up with a brand.
I even have the same profile pictures on everything. Oh, what?
You know what I really enjoy? When This tends to be a certain type of person, but when people will go on Facebook and change their name, like delete their last name and switch it with their middle name, or they'll like truncate their name to like just the first three letters of each name. That way they're like, they're way more obscured and they're harder to find. So if you're already friends with them or you know where to look, you can find them. But if you're a potential employer, you can't see any of the incriminating evidence, which I think is a funny shift in
society. Well, I was fascinated about that. I don't think about it from an employer standpoint, but a landlord standpoint. If you're not on there, I actually become a lot more suspicious. Because now there are a bunch of unknowns that I can't answer, and I can answer them for other people. So it's almost like, okay, sure, no incriminating evidence, but there's also no good evidence. And so it's an interesting balance that I don't know if there's a good answer for. It's kind of like one of those, here's an idea, don't post stupid things, and then you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, and and it's funny. I know sometimes people will say, well, just don't do stupid things. But that's not the trick. Like, I do plenty of stupid things. I just don't post about them.
Yes.
I just talk about them on my podcast.
It's audio. It's fine. They don't index that yet.
Exactly.
When they do, you're in trouble. Yeah. Anyways, there was a whole point to this. I can't remember. Whatever. We're still in the intro, but... giving interesting factoids.
Yeah, if you want, okay, and then the important stuff. So all year long, every time we do a show, we post all sorts of metadata about the show, whether that's the link to the podcast, the link to the YouTube video. But the other metadata, and this is the really clutch stuff, is all the articles we talk about. And it kind of creates this really great catalog of what happened this last year. We recommend you go and spend hours poring over all the links of the last year just to see, because it's interesting. That's what I'm going to be doing over the next week or two. I recommend
I'm
you
so
join
happy
me
that you have volunteered to do that.
No, that's every year, man. That's what I do.
I owe you a Christmas present for that. Oh, not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, the best part about it James, is that I'm going to be working next week and the week after, so... at least part of my work week is going to be devoted to that.
Nice.
I actually will probably be working when I really think about it, because I wouldn't actually be at work if I didn't have a lot of work to do. So it'd be really stupid of me to spend my time that way. Anyways.
You'll figure it out.
Yeah. So let's see here. What are we going to be doing? Let's talk tech, James. Let's talk tech. I highlight. That's why I'm totally thrown off, because this is inside the show, guys. We highlight all of our articles, what we're going to talk about in the order we talk about them. And I highlighted my first article wrong. So I have a question, James. Have you seen Apple's new iPad / Mac?
Oh my commercial? Gosh. Yeah, and I also watched the behind the scenes video about the commercial, because I don't want to steal your thunder. Go ahead.
No. Talk about it. Go for it.
I love it. I'm just like, as a marketer, I'm like, dang, that's really well done. really well done. I mean, the commercial itself, which is like a 90-second, like, it's not a real commercial, I don't think. I don't know. Do they have 90-second commercials on TV? Is that a thing?
You can buy a 90-second spot.
Well, if anyone can afford it, they can.
A lot of times it's like movie stuff. You might see it in like before a movie.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's this 90-second commercial. If you haven't seen it yet, it's one of those heartwarming pull on the old heartstrings type of thing where a young girl who apparently is a real musician finds an old record that's recorded by her grandma, of her singing a love song to her husband, who I'm guessing is now deceased, and so she somehow magically gets it onto her computer. They kind of just gloss over that part, but that's cool. And then she's got it in GarageBand, and she's listening to it, and she comes up with harmonies and accompaniment to her grandmother singing. And then ultimately puts it on, was it an iPad or an iPhone?
Yeah,
or
it was an iPad.
iPod? Is that a thing still?
They're trying to sell iPads, so they put it on an iPad.
Got it. She puts it on an iPad, and the grandma listens to it. And so the first part of the commercial, this is what this is, it's commercial.
Yes.
which I'm like, yeah, it's not quite as good as the IKEA commercials, which by the way are also fantastic, and it's just a great concept. But anyways, you're hearing the song with just the grandma's voice, like the old scratchy recording style, and then like the second half of it, it's the grandma's listening to it, and it's got all the accompaniment, and you know, we're all crying and blubbering at the end of it. We're like, it's so beautiful, and it's good, and so I like it, and I was like, okay, you know, that's cool, and it's just called The Song, apparently, is the name of the commercial.
Yes.
And then they decided to come out with the video of making of the commercial, which is like a 2.5 minute video.
And I think like, it's they decided. It's like, yeah. So it wasn't part of the complete marketing plan.
Right. No, it
the
totally
second
was.
Commercial.
Yes. Yeah. And that one's even better. Because they actually went and like found one of those old school style recording booths and had a lady sing into it. So like the scratchy's like that's real. They didn't just add that in as like an After Effect thing. And then like I said, the main girl, she's actually a music artist, and so she's sitting there talking about how like she actually mixed it and put it together. And she talks about how like, oh yeah, I did it using GarageBand and it's cool, and they're just going through and just talking about the technology and how it enables them to do it, and it was just kind of like, it was neat where she's not just an actress just making it up, like she did it, and that was neat. I don't know, it's definitely a touchy-feely type of commercial. Doesn't have a whole lot to do with the technology other than it's classic Apple, where it's like, we're not going to talk about speeds and feeds. Wait, that's what we were talking about with printers. We're not going to talk about... Is that still appropriate? you know what I mean. You know, they're not going to talk about stats. We're going to say, here's what you can do with it. And instead of... You know, they got their normal commercials, right, where it's like, here's the 50 things that you can do with it, and they're showing all the quick... You know, it's got the fun, fast music, and it's like it's jumping between a whole bunch of different scenes of people doing amazing things on their devices. And, you know, and now, even Microsoft is now going after them, and they're doing, you know, the whole side by side, their own version of a Mac versus PC, just not as well done. And, you know, talking about, okay, let's go again, spec by spec, and let's talk about all the different things you can do with it. Whereas this one's like, we're going to do one, just arrow to the heart. Here's one thing that you could do with it.
Okay, this is
clearly I'm a fanboy, in case you could not tell. But I like good marketing, so what can I say?
This is, it's funny, I actually stand up for Microsoft, because I watch enough movies, and Microsoft is hitting that market hard. That's like where most of their advertising budget is going to. It's like pre-movie, you're sitting there waiting. Instead of doing trivia nowadays, they do this. They show Microsoft commercials. And I've been sitting there with people saying, it's so like, man, it's just so classless to make fun of Apple like that. And I'm like, dude, do you remember the Mac versus PC commercials? Like that's all. When you're the underdog, you attack the king. That's what you do in marketing. Like that's the whole game of it. I'm like, oh yeah. I said, but it is interesting because they feel different. And I've decided that I think what the big difference is. Was the fact that Apple knew they didn't have to show the computers. They never showed the hardware in those commercials. Right. It was John Hodgman and what's his name? That one kid that nobody likes except, I don't know, I think he's cool.
I like him. Movies.
I know.
He's hilarious.
He's hilarious, yeah.
Dodgeball, fantastic.
Exactly. John Long, something long, whatever, it doesn't matter. Point
Justin.
Is, yeah, Bam. Justin Thank Long. You. the point is that they, you know, they never felt compelled to show the hardware. They just did it a little bit differently. And it's funny in this commercial, it almost gets to the point where if it weren't for the fact that, you know, you know it's Apple hardware. You know it's an Apple commercial because YouTube tells you it's Apple. You almost wouldn't necessarily know at first that it's for the Apple ecosystem until the very, very end. You know, it's just not the focus of the commercial. And like you said, it's just it's really good storytelling because it's, you know, one of the things that they talk about in great storytelling is show, don't tell, right? It's right. Show people what, you know, the emotion that they're feeling. Don't tell them what they're feeling. And that's how you convey it. And it's a more difficult writing style until you kind of get used to it. And then it's just, and then anytime somebody tells you something, it's super annoying. Show it to me, convey it. And then here what they're doing is it's just a whole bunch of show, don't tell to the effect of they're almost, and this is actually when one of the greatest tricks in writing is, when you're, especially when you're learning how to do that, is sometimes they'll say, figure out what you're trying to convey, whatever emotion it is you're trying to convey, or like the idea, and then write the entire story without ever using that word. Just avoid it at all costs. It's the one thing you can't say. You can talk around it. You can convey ideas about it. So if like you're trying to write a scary story, never use the word fear or terror or scary. Talk around it. Or if in this case you're trying to sell iPads, never actually talk about the iPad. Convey everything around the iPad. And then we just naturally fill in the blanks. And that's the thing that when Apple is at its best, and when their commercial machine is at their best, that's what they're doing. And they're never talking, they never actually talk about the hardware. They talk around it. They almost do their best to avoid it. Just because the absence of it, it actually draws your attention to it. As you said before, the lack of evidence is almost as incriminating as evidence can be. And in this is a similar thing. You fill in the void. You're like, because they don't tell you what it can do, you just sort of imagine it can do everything. And, it can make music. And it's funny. If you hadn't told me that the scratchy voice thing wasn't an after effect, I would have just assumed it was an after effect you could throw into...
I know.
It almost makes you wonder, why can't you? Wait a second, I want that feature. If I buy it, I want it.
you probably can.
Yeah. But, you know.
And they didn't have to tell us that.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the point. So, I don't know. I thought it was worth mentioning because it's, you know, we like to talk about marketing is such a big part of this because people drive these technologies. And marketing, you know, like as an engineer, sometimes you like to think the best products are what makes it, but that's not the case. It's what you can sell is what becomes the most popular, and how you sell it is important. So, thought it was worth bringing
up. I've been listening to some podcasts, which by the way, I have one I want to recommend to you, and it's called Startup. Have you listened to that? It's like a mini series podcast.
You mentioned it last week. A startup podcast, right?
Yeah. Okay, good. I already mentioned it. But I was listening to a different one. Not that one. Different commercial. And I was listening to an interview of a blogger who I really like following. And I've actually taken some of his online courses, and he was talking about naming of courses. And he's like, you don't name the course what it is. It's like, you name the course what the results are. Okay, like, for example... he has a course that's about how to find a job and you know, you could simply name it, you know, I don't know, how to find a job 101 or 202 or something like that. No, yeah. This is called Dream Job. Yeah. Right. And then you're like, or another one, it could be like, how to freelance or something. And instead it's earn 1K on the side is the name of the course. And again, it's this idea of talk about what it gets you. Talk about those, you know, that ultimate thing that you're looking for and put that into the title. And that's what they're doing with this commercial. You know, you don't want to make a song just for the fun of making a song, you know,
right.
That is enabling another feeling that you're going for.
Right.
And that's what they highlight. That's what they talk about.
Cross-generational communication and emotions.
Yeah, whatever. You know, you want to make it's a, you know, it's that perfect time of year, which, you know, they had that Christmas one last year. And Or just, oh, you want to do something nice for your family? Apple can help you do that. Let's talk about that emotion and that feeling. No, I think they're the type of marketing that they do is fantastic. Google, I would say, it's kind of funny. And we'll talk about this a little later. So this, I guess this is the tease for Google doing their end of the year stuff. You know, where they do their, it's not the zeitgeist quite yet. It's just more like top searches for the year. And when they made a video for it, and it's another, like, it's an emotional video about searches. And it's this idea that, you know, you can tell that they're very smart. I've got a massive amount of respect for Google. And it's like super smart engineers. And they went, emotional videos are really important. Let's make one.
Right.
And so they do, and they're really smart, so they do a good job at it. And it comes off as like, oh, it's really good. But we'll talk about that a little later. But I think they're another company that has figured that out and is doing really well. Microsoft, for some reason, has not figured that out. It's super frustrating.
I will say this, though.
Oh, go ahead.
I think the Xbox division has figured that out, because their commercials regularly, I think, oh, why did I buy a PlayStation 4? And then I remember, oh yeah, that's right, I like the games on PlayStation 4 more. My friends are there. I like it. But they're so good with their, dude, the Halo Master Chief collection of games. Like, we were sitting there getting ready for the Battle of Five Armies, and Timmy and I, and we were like looking at each other like thinking, dude, if we like buy an Xbox together, we could like switch off month to month. Like, you have it for 1 month, I have it for 1 month, and then we could play it. Like, that's how good those commercials are. But they, you know, it's ridiculous. And thankfully, I think the high of the moment has worn off. But
I guess I was thinking more about their Surface.
Yeah, but I was going to say, but the rest of their divisions, it's obviously not the same marketing team, because they're terrible. I mean, they're just not good. They don't. They kind of make me feel woozy. Like, oh, really? This is what you're trying to do? You know.
And then you get ones like Facebook, where they get all into the emotional stuff, but they go too far.
Yeah.
Like, wait, what was this about?
Yeah.
Still, the message was lost upon me.
Yeah.
It was this awkwardly long commercial about a chair? I don't understand. Facebook?
It's cool, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, that was fascinating. No, they're cool. They do a good job. I like it. I like it. Okay, so let's switch gears here. Let's talk about language.
Okay.
Specifically, how to speak startup. I love these kind of posts. TechCrunch did one. It's Alex Wilhelm. I'll give him credit because he's at Alex. Ooh, he got in early. That's impressive.
Seriously. And that's him. Too bad his social network's getting crushed.
So we've had him on the... we've had David Perry on the show a little bit, and he's at David Perry. And when they finally came out with the search tool that said when you gave your first tweet, he totally could have had at David, because I know. And he just, like, in retrospect, he was like, I'm such an idiot.
Yeah.
I was like, man, that would have been awesome. But yeah, he's like, now I know. Next time, he goes, I'll just get them both. I'm not going to worry about it. You know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, seriously. Dang. Anyways, he's got a fun article today that he says, hang with startup kids long enough, and you'll notice that they have their own language. No, bro, it's a SaaS play on the on-demand food space. Think of it as the Uber for gluten-free Whole Foods delivery, okay? He goes, and it never ends. We're actively raising, but we really want to make sure that we hit investor board fit before product market sink, you know? It's like, yeah, that could be confusing. So,
you know what the worst part about it is, James? I know exactly what you're talking about, because, like, I'm hanging with these kids now.
You're living it. You're living it. Yeah, so you will appreciate this. I know you will. And so he gives, in my old school style, I would call it a data dictionary. But essentially, like, here's some terms and here's what they mean. And it's, and in case you haven't figured it out yet, this is very tongue in cheek, but it's good. So, number one, and this isn't in alphabetical order, which kind of bugs me, but, you know, I would don't worry about that. Acquire, which is actually the first one that should be in the list, which is good. He says, this is a strategy for acquiring talent pioneered by Google in the mid-2000s. That happens when a bigger company thinks your team is good, but your idea is hilariously bad. He goes, also called a signing bonus. Like, yeah, that is what that is. How about failure? This is a bad thing that the Silly Valley has recently put on a pedestal as something to be celebrated.
Oh my gosh. Oh, that's hilarious. That goes back to just a couple weeks ago. I was talking about people like VCs saying nobody wants to work with you if you haven't failed. Because you have to, like, you know, if you haven't failed, you haven't tried. Which is like, in one degree, like, stupid. Yes. If you meet somebody who's never failed just because they're really good, that's actually who I want to work with.
Yeah. Huh. The Google guys didn't fail when they started. So,
exactly.
Cash flow positive. Someone gave us a dollar. Yes. I like pivot. This is classic. This was like a really hot term a couple years ago. What happens when a company realizes its course of action is not living up to expectations? The classic historic example is The Point, which became Groupon after the company posted a coupon to a pizza place in The Point's building in Chicago. See also failure. Which is true. How about a software as a service, SaaS? It loses money. Yes. Oh, I
That's
love it.
Funny.
Pre-money valuation, a number you made up. Post-money valuation is a number that you made up alongside your VC with the addition of some cash. Your burn rate is probably too high.
Yeah.
I like it. Oh, yeah, sure. Come on in, Vin. Let's see here. Exits come in two different flavors for entrepreneurs, good and bad. Good exits happen when you're killing it, your company hasn't killed you, and another company comes along to buy yours. See, possibly acquihire. Exits are another way of saying you failed to disrupt much of anything besides your VC's portfolio performance. Take that. Let's see here. I'm a serial entrepreneur, person who had two ideas, both of which failed. That's just mean. It just hurts.
I just can't even. Oh my god. Oh, this makes me hate everybody.
There you go. Oh, then you'll appreciate this one. The space. Because calling the field in which you're operating an industry, vertical, or even genre is too hard. Entrepreneurs like referring to their company as being a player in a given space. They especially like doing this when they know they're in a crowded market, but don't know why they're... Oh, it says... Okay, sorry. Wow, I just destroyed that sentence. They especially like doing this when they know they're in a crowded market. And it finishes with... We don't know why they do this either.
Yeah, yes. That's funny.
So space. I thought this was interesting. VC has two definitions. The first one is venture capitalists raise money from wealthy individuals and institutions and dump lots of said money into young companies in exchange for a cut of the company. Or, number two, an institutional dealer of pharmaceutical-grade opium. I love it. And then opium... could also be OPM or other people's money. It's an incredibly addictive substance to entrepreneurs that's rarely respected or missed until it dries up. Well, very true. How about the quote, "We're doing great," really means we're not doing great. Yes, I love it. Let's see here. "We're growing 500% week over week," really means last week we had one user, today we have six.
Yeah, right.
Yes, and then I appreciated this one. Another quote: "We're a design-centric organization." Really means we don't know how to code. Take that.
Yeah, that is hilarious. Man, oh.
You like that, huh? Let's see here. So I'm the business guy. They go, "See free rider problem or growth hacker." And $32 million Series A round is something that's doomed to fail. And then I like this one, growth hacking, again, which we were told to see earlier. It's the sales, marketing, and associated activities, but with a label that incorporates the word hacking because non-technical people want to call themselves hackers, too.
That's hilarious.
That's true. I, for a while, wanted to call myself an analytical engineer. So, like, engineers are cool. I want to be one. And then we just have some other, you know, lines. We're seeing great gross margins and so are investing in growth given our strong SaaS unit economics, which essentially means we're losing money. We're stomping on the gas pedal given our strong SaaS unit economics and are actively seeking additional capital to power our sector, our sector leading growth. We have lost all our money and need some of yours, please. And then finally, we're crushing it. Your dreams and investors' dollars are probably being crushed. First rule of Fight Club, bro. Just don't talk about it.
Yeah. So that's, gosh, that is just that unbelievably is accurate.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that is just frustrating right there, man. I mean, like, yeah, it's tongue in cheek, but at the same time, it's like I've heard all of these and like throwing them around. What's your exit strategy? What are you doing? You know, it's the Valley, man. This is what we're doing. You know, software as a service.
By the way, the Valley. I think I actually skipped over that one. It's a place that VCs and tech luminaries talk up as the greatest place on earth that you must move to if you're from anywhere that isn't San Francisco or the Valley.
Yeah. Well. I mean, I genuinely like it here, but it's because pretty much all of my interests can take place here. So, it's just the problem is this goes back to what we were just talking about. Marketing is important. Somebody needs to sell this stuff, and if you're an engineer with a great idea and the best product. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win. Doesn't mean you're going to win a lot of money. Like, having the best product is not always the best. There's plenty of times where everybody will sit down and look at something and say, yeah, it didn't win. Why? You know, Betamax is the classic example of, well, it was a better technology, but it didn't take off. I would say VCRs in the long run ended up being a better technology just because they got more time, money, devotion, TLC than Betamax did. But at the same time, you know, maybe their headroom wasn't as much. But the important part was it was a bigger company that sold it harder and they won. So it's like, and a lot of times what you'll end up with is a lot of people are more sales, more business oriented, and they want to wow you with their vocabulary. They want to wow you with everything. They want the wow factor. That's really important. You got to blow people away and get them excited. And yeah. You know, the reality of it is, yeah, you got to do that sometimes. The problem is it's like once you've actually been wowed, and there are wow things out. It's sort of like the word awesome. Awesome used to be. See, it's hard to talk about the word awesome without doing exactly what I'm about to say. Is it's like, what does awesome mean? It means it literally inspires awe. What is awe? It's just this like enrapturing feeling that brings you to your knees. It is awe inspiring. It is awesome. And you know, and you can't even. It's this word that has a tremendous amount of impact. And the more you use it, the less meaningful it is. Well, a lot of these things have meaning. And like originally had impactful, important meaning, but they get overused because you're borrowing vocabulary. It's kind of like, you know, swear words and the whole idea of if you know, they're supposed to be they have a tremendous amount of power because they're so rarely used, but they have no power if they're used with incredible frequency. And so it's all about, you know, it's all about that balance. And that's the funny part about this is it's like, what's your exit strategy? You know, it kind of makes sense, but at the same time, it's like, what's your, you know, sometimes let's just talk about our product. What's our value? What's our, you know, what do we do? I don't know. It's just, and you get lost in the vocabulary sometimes. And that's the point. It's as this thing is pointing out, it's to obfuscate, what the heck is that word? Obfuscate. Obfuscate. Yeah, it is. It's there. I mean, I'm saying it right. Yeah, obfuscate. Jeez, that is a hard word for me to get out right now.
I couldn't say absent earlier, so it's okay.
Thank you. I appreciate you giving me permission. But that's the point of those things, is to as obfuscate means, render obscure, uncleared, or unintelligible what you're actually trying to do. It's supposed to, you know, it's supposed to, I don't know, it's dumb.
I saw a great, I can't remember where I read it. I feel like I read it in a book, but it might have been an article. It was a Robert Kiyosaki, author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, best-selling author that he likes to point out. And he was being interviewed by another journalist.
I pointed out, too.
And he was being interviewed by another journalist, and she was just like, you know, they kind of got done with the official interview, and so unofficially she says, like, you know, she goes, I want to know how you're a best-selling author. She's like, I think that I write well, but I just can't, you know, no one's going to pick up my book and it's just not selling. And she's like, I just, you know, I need to write better. And he goes, no, you don't. He goes, I'm not a good writer. He goes, I'm a horrible writer, but I'm good at sales and marketing. And, yeah. Goes, and that's why I'm the best-selling author, is you need to sell your work. And she's like, and she like got offended by the fact, which is what made it an interesting thing. And she was just like, she didn't understand how she could be a better author, and yet he could sell a lot more than her. He was like, well, it's not just about how good the product is. You know, sales are important.
Yeah.
But
yeah, you know, being a good salesperson is you know,
but
having a good
the valley can become a bit of an echo chamber, and
yeah,
that can cause a problem.
That's true.
You know, because they're all smart people, right? We all pick up on the patterns. I'm going to lump myself into that group. We all pick up on the patterns and then optimize for them. You know, that's what happens when you have a whole bunch of engineers around. You know, they find something good, they go, oh, that seems to be working. We're all going to do it now. And so it has a very short shelf life on actually being meaningful and useful.
Yeah, it's true.
That's part of the addicted fun of it all, though.
Yeah.
All right, man. What are we talking about next? Is it me?
Go for it. Yeah.
All right. Well, the year is coming to a close, as we have hinted at. And Google's taken notice. And like we hinted at earlier.
They looked at the calendar.
Yeah, they're like, oh, it's getting near the end here. And so they published their 10 most popular searches for different categories. And there's some interesting ones. And like I said, they put together a nice little video. We'll link to it, of course, on furloughbros.com. And it's a fun little video where, is it, like I said, they take the emotional bent on it, which is fine. Number one on the, I feel like this is the global list that they're looking at. It's the same no matter what. Starts with a quote, "You're only given a little spark of madness. You mustn't lose it." Spoken by Mr. Robin Williams. He is, I mean, that's kind of like, it doesn't feel like it was that long ago.
Right.
And he's got number one slot for that one. Pretty crazy.
Yeah.
A bunch of people looked up the words or related searches, I guess, would be like Aladdin and Dead Poet Society. And
yeah.
So, you know, which were two classics. I mean, like, Dead Poet Society is like, it's a movie about him, kind of. Or his philosophy, I should say. Buck the trend, do something different. Highly recommend it if you haven't seen it already, Captain. All right. These lists are like almost identical, whatever. Number two has to do with the world stage. And I am proud to say that I participated in partaking in the World Cup via my home computer. It's pretty good, man. I mean, you know, you had Luis Suarez biting somebody. You had Tim Howard's Superman performance against Belgium. Germany got their fourth title. It was one of those where they were like, this was good. This was good. You know, it was a good year. I know I for one really enjoyed it. Let's see here. Number three, or what are we on now? Yeah, number three on both lists was the Ebola virus or outbreak, yeah. I guess. Pretty big deal. Number four, Malaysia Airlines. That was just like, that was a weird one. You know, like, how do you lose a plane? It's just strange.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's still, you know, we'll be talking about that in 20 years. What happened to the Malaysian Airlines flight?
Well, I know for me, too, it was like, for me, I suddenly realized, or it helped me realize, I guess, how big the world is.
Yeah. It's
like, you can lose an airplane. I don't know, you could do that. I didn't know you could lose anything anymore. And, no, it turns out the world's still ginormous, which is impressive. Finally, the lists start to diverge here. Number five on the global trending is the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. That did go pretty viral pretty quick here. If you're just in the U.S., it was beat out by Flappy Birds. They flip-flopped between the two there. Let's see here. Number seven is, oh my gosh, I don't even know what that is. What is that? Conchita Wurst? Should I know what that is?
Which one's that one?
That's number seven on the global trending searches. Wow, I'm a horrible person. I don't even know what that is.
Well, no. This one's, it's a performer in Australia who happens to be a drag queen artist. And yeah, it's just, it's because it's a world, it's actually the entire world that one's up there. Like, nobody in America knows who that is.
Got it.
It's a pretty minor search by American standards.
Huh, interesting. ISIS is another one that's pretty high up there. Mm-hmm. Let's see, Frozen made the list this year.
Which is a testament.
On the global searching, Sochi Olympics made it on. Wasn't nice. Cool for the U.S. Instead, it was Ferguson and Ukraine. What are the other two on the list? Pretty interesting.
No, the world doesn't care about Ukraine. They care about ISIS.
By the way, this is a fun fact. This was the first year in a few where an Apple product did not make the cut.
Yeah. Hey, that's interesting.
Yeah, unless you count Flappy Birds as an Apple product, but, you know. Yeah, no. Apple, not being talked about, which makes sense because they didn't do anything until, like, September. So, right. They don't have enough time to get on the old list, unless you're Robin Williams.
Yeah, no. And all they did was come out with a bigger phone, let's be honest. Do something exciting. Like, watch.
Yeah, innovate. I got a couple apps I want to share later on. I go through these, or right now.
Go for it.
We'll tease them. I go through these phases where I don't play games, and then it's like I play a lot of games, and I'm in that phase where I've got two games I want to share because they're pretty awesome.
Go for it.
But we'll get there. We'll save it for the end.
Okay. All right. Teasing it. So I read a really interesting article. It's a super long article.
Is that the brief history of Yahoo?
Yeah.
Obviously you're being,
well, it is brief by, you know, Yahoo's history standards.
Fair enough.
But it's basically kind of covers what is Yahoo, what happened there, what's going on, what's going on with Marissa Mayer and the whole dealio. Because one of the really interesting ideas that this points out is this sort of is their valuation is somewhere around $33 billion right now, their stock valuation, which is pretty impressive. It's a good chunk of change. Except that they have a holding, they own part of Alibaba, the giant internet conglomerate from China that's just gone public. And the portion of Alibaba that they own is worth like $37 million, which is like, so their actual evaluation, if they were to sell Alibaba, they would be worth -$4 billion. Which is not good for a company that is actively making money. So it's like, it's just the sentiment for Yahoo is bad. On one hand, that means they're a good investing opportunity right now if you're into buying stocks, because you know, theoretically there's room for them to grow. They're worth more than they are, and if they were to sell their Alibaba stock, they would they'd have a ton of money and, you know, be able to do things with that. The most likely scenario,
did my money finally go through? It's a weekend, probably not, right, if it hasn't already.
Mine hasn't.
Well, if yours hasn't, mine hasn't. Oh no, I'm good to go. Boom!
You're good to go.
I can buy Alibaba stock right now. Woo! Oh no, Yahoo stock right now.
Which is effectively the same thing. Let's see. Mine transfer is still pending.
Yahoo.
But
what's their stock trading at?
Here,
$51.
Oh man, you could buy a lot of Yahoo stock.
I could.
Yahoo.
I didn't put that much money into my account.
That's right. One of the things that happens, though, that I find most interesting about this is that what they're saying is really the best move would be for somebody like Google or Apple to come along and buy them. Because you could sell the Alibaba stock and effectively get the company and make $4 billion the moment you sold the stock. And even a smaller company like AOL could buy them out completely on credit with, you know, one of your giant banks or a couple of giant banks and say, and we're going to sell the stock and we'll all cut the profits and or all take a cut of the profit from the Alibaba stock. And then when all is said and done, we'll, you know, we'll happily merrily go on our way. And
that's an interesting thought.
And yeah, so it's like the idea that Yahoo won't be around at the end of 2015, you know, by 2015 is kind of on investors' minds. There's quite a few investor, what are those called? Those guys that have activist investors who are talking, they're trying to get together their dollars and their friends to buy a big enough stake of a company like AOL to try to force the merger that they can sell the Alibaba stock. And it's, you know, so it's I don't actually see that happening in the next year, because I think Marissa Mayer's not given up yet. But one of the cool parts about this article is it kind of runs through the history of what Yahoo was, how it came to be, and why we care about it. And it's funny because it's like, you know, you hear the legendary stories of Google tried to, you know, Larry Brannon, Sergey, what's his name?
Larry Page, Sergey Brin. It's fine. You can mix them up.
You know, whatever. It's not like this is what we talk about on the show. They tried to sell their algorithm for search to Yahoo, and Yahoo was like, that's stupid. You need a person. And obviously Yahoo made a good decision and won in the end. you know, you hear those kinds of stories, but it's funny because I wasn't like old enough to really be following it. But there's just parts of it that I didn't really understand about that historical context of what was their value proposition. And like their whole deal was originally Yahoo started as the two creators. They basically had a list of websites that they thought were cool. So they had this index, which was basically links of websites that they thought was cool. And then as that thing grew, it became sort of this front page of the internet sort of site. And people would go there looking for content of websites that were cool. And then the search system sort of became this way of indexing the sites that they were already interested in. And Google's whole innovation on that was that they had a team of people that were going through the internet looking for interesting content or looking for content, and then were categorizing that content by hand. And Google said,
I remember in my first website, I had to submit it to the Yahoo index, and it wasn't an instant thing. It was like someone presumably had to check out the link and click on it before adding it.
Yeah.
It was like
exactly.
Yeah.
And Google's innovation was the whole spider idea was, we'll create a script on a server that will go out and click on all the links in a website and see where those websites go. We'll gather information from those websites. We'll look at the metadata. We'll look at the site there. And we'll use that to categorize every website. And so the entire linked internet, what you might refer to as the shallow internet, as opposed to the deep internet, which is the things that aren't interconnected, right. That they could categorize the entire thing without human intervention, ideally. Obviously, there's an army of people that participate in that nowadays, and engineers, but because there's servers doing most of the legwork, they're able to go 99% further, and then they improved their searching algorithm, and they, you know, mollywomped on Yahoo. And that's sort of like, that to me was always what I'd thought of the whole deal, was Yahoo was a search company and they got beat by Google. But that's just not the case. Like, the reality of it was, they were the first advertising company, like the first internet ad company. And their whole deal was, they brought all sorts of content together. And they had a bunch of clever ideas. They had things like an auction site. They had classifieds. They had news. They had all sorts of things that they were becoming this massive hub of the internet. That was their goal. And their whole thing was, people would come and look at their website. So they started to put advertisements on their website. And you're like, oh, okay. I get it. I kind of see what's going on. And while although Yahoo's search algorithm was really their cool selling feature, the classifieds was huge. They had tons of traffic from classifieds. And then their whole auction site was also really, really popular. And then along came a dude named Craig, and he created a list of classifieds and said, we're not going to charge you for it. And Craigslist started to gain prominence. And then my boy Elon teamed up with eBay, and that whole product package started to really, the security and the ease and everything that came along with that really started to take off. And so those were the three biggest products that Yahoo had, and that brought eyes to their website, that paid their advertising allowed them to pay their dollars in advertising. And then all of a sudden their usership just started to plunge as those other three websites really started to take off. And that is really what led to the collapse of Yahoo. And then they went through their sort of chain of CEOs trying to figure out what to do with their lives. And finally, Marissa Mayer of Google fame, after her bout with a couple engineers and not getting the promotion she felt she deserved, jumped ship, went over to Yahoo, and started there. And trying to answer the question of what the heck is going on right now, why is the company worth -$4 billion, is difficult to really articulate. And the article is pretty good. I'd recommend reading it. It's hard to summarize, though, because one of the things that she really felt is like she could be sort of a Steve Jobs-esque type character, come in and turn a massive tech company around, because that just doesn't happen very often. Usually these things, you become a juggernaut, momentum shifts. And this is the classic innovator's dilemma. And so her whole deal was, we're going to cut everything. We're going to cut everything but a small set of core products. We're going to fill in our ecosystem of products, and we're going to get really good at doing a few things. And her big thing was, we're going to get really good at doing mobile. And so Tumblr with a good mobile app, and the News Digest thing with their app, and you know, weather and everything else that they do is becoming hyper-focused on mobility, which is, you know, their mobility-first platform. And
you just don't see any, okay, outside of Facebook, I guess, any huge mobile companies. And I would argue Facebook's not a mobile company, but despite what they say.
Yeah.
Sure, that could be true, but you got to shrink down a whole lot if you're going to become a mobile company.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. You know, it's funny. I still sit there and I go, I personally think Facebook's whole "we're a mobile first company." Well, it's funny. I would say the statement of if they say we're a mobile company, they're liars. If they say we're a mobile first company, which and by that I would mean we are a hardware specific applications interface. That's our first priority. Our first priority isn't platform independent interfaces. So, aka HTML versus iOS/Android. And that's all there. That's if that's what you mean. If your whole statement is we build an Android app, we build an iOS app, and then we retrograde those cool features to. And when we test stuff out, we test it out on a native platform, and then we bring those features back to the website last. Then I think it's an accurate statement. And there's
that's what they mean. They just don't do it in practice.
Right. And then I was going to say, but it's a bigger problem. It's like, ultimately what, you know, I've said it before. It's like, it's about how you see your top priority. Is it really, really solid, great engineering? Is it really interesting content? Is it really great music? Is it really good TV shows? Is it a ton of TV shows? Is it cheap? Is it free? Is it expensive? Is it, you know, what is your most valued asset? What is the thing that you put above all else? And I would say a company like Google and like Facebook, their whole thing is not necessarily we're going to be is search or is social network or is mobility or is, you know, HTML. Like, that's not what they're great at. What they're great at is we're going to, whatever we do, it's going to work, period. They just generate a tremendous amount of bug-free code. And so every time they try stuff, it works. It's reliable. If you like it, if you like the idea, if you buy into it, you can expect that it will be reliable, which is, by the way, what Apple does with hardware. You know, all of these companies that get really great, that's what they do, and that's their first priority before anything else. And then it allows them to move into doing whatever. And I would say the Yahoo products that I use, yeah, they work. I think that there is, and this is why I say I don't think you're going to see Yahoo get bought, as I think Marissa Mayer's focus is similar to that, is it's got to work well. It's got to be right. They cite things of where she wanted to make a color change and just drove her one of her chief technologists insane, because realizing that it's like changing this color a few points is not a big deal, you know, is how is that going to be a big deal? But she said, no, it's got to be right. Huh. And he's like, yeah, but we're about to launch this product, and it is going to be a tremendous amount of work to get that done in time. And she's, but it's got to be right. You know, and that sort of a focus has a long-term effect. I am actually willing to say that we haven't given her enough time to change this behemoth company or to turn it around.
How long has she been in charge for?
I think it's like 2 years.
Oh yeah, and she's got three more.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's funny, and it's this. But obviously, if there's $4 billion in profit on the table, you know, it's the investors are starting to get. They're seeing that, man. They're licking their chops, and
yeah, but you see, if that starts to happen, all she does, they just sell some Alibaba stock, get cash back, and. And you just watch that balance start become less attractive, because you do exactly what the investors would have done. You just don't sell, and you take away what it is that they want. I mean, that's
true.
You know, that's what I would do today. And then, because I don't think anybody believes that it's a negative $4 billion, which. No. If anything, you just sit there and say they're undervalued. They're undervalued.
It can't be that.
Well, and the problem that they'd run into is that if you tried to go and buy enough stock, guess what? The stock price is going to bump up enough to add $4 billion back to it. So yeah. It just that's the way that's going to work. For whatever reason, they're flying under the radar. It's a mathematical weirdness. I do agree that it's saying that they're not creating any value. But all she has to do is convert it to the cash, and now she goes, now I have an opportunity to create value, and I think I can do better than AOL.
Which I would agree.
Hey,
from what I read about her, you know.
That's unfortunately for, I mean, so I don't, so all that to say, it's, the other thing too is like, honestly, $4 billion is not a big enough number on a base of 37. That's just, for the time and effort that will be required to pull that off, you're going to spend $8 billion. It's not a big enough payoff. So she's fine. She's got the time. It's, I'm kind of with you though, where it's like, man, if we genuinely believe this, let's open up our Robinhood apps and bet on it. And, you know, see what happens. And in 3 years, you ante up, you know, how'd that work out for us?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. Because, I mean,
along for HP.
Yeah. Honestly, when I making that statement of, do I think, you know, would I bet on, you know, I make that comment of, I think Marissa Mayer could add more value to Yahoo than AOL could. And that's actually not even just a dig at AOL, like, which it very easily could be. But I actually think that, you know, maybe this is not something that she's perfectly suited for, but I get the feeling from reading about her, she's got the right mentalities. You get the right team around her, and they're going to focus on great technology, and they're going to find solutions. You know, it's all about, it's, you know, it goes back to that Steve Jobs didn't do what he did with Apple in a 10-year period because Steve Jobs is a brilliant engineer and marketer. Steve Jobs did what he did because he found brilliant engineers and marketers that he could instill with his principles and ideas, and then they took their talents, their time, and their energy and turned it into what it is today. You know, it was the whole.
Could you imagine how much longer it would have taken him if he had to find or acquire or hire Johnny Ives instead of him just happening to be working there already, kind of already ingrained in the culture and the thought? He got a 2-year head start just on that.
Oh yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Having to not find your Johnny Ives is just a, you know, that, and that's
just
the trick,
go,
right?
Whoa, you're right here. This is incredible. Awesome. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's funny. I mean, I remember when I started at HP, I had a friend, we'll call him David Perry. Pretty much that's who I interact with at work. And it's kind of fun. Well, you know, when you're just on the phone all day and everyone else lives in other parts of the world, you know, it's who you hang out with. But not to diminish my friendship with him. He's genuinely fun to hang out with. But the point of what I was going to say was, again, he was on Twitter very early, as we've already established. No one else on the team or in our area was on it. They're like, Twitter's dumb. And I came along and was like, I went, hey, have you guys heard of this thing called Twitter? I just discovered it. It's kind of crazy. And David's like, yeah, been on it for like 6 months. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, which, that's who he is. It's always a race to see who's first. And and I usually
lose. Technology.
Yeah. And so we started using it. You know, just like sitting at my desk, ready for lunch. You know what I mean? We were using Twitter the dumb way in the beginning when it was literally a status update. We took it literally and updated our status. And and it went, like I said, he'd been using it for 6 months, could convince nobody to get on it. It might have even been longer. But I got on it, and it was like within 3 weeks, maybe not even that. It might have been like 2 weeks, the first person did it. And then that next week, two other people did it. And by within a month, everybody in our group was on it.
Well, it's funny.
To encapsulate that thought, it was when you're just alone shouting at the wind and trying to convince people to move, it's incredibly difficult and hard. And he fought it, you know, or, you know, was pushing unsuccessfully for a long time. Once he found that partner, and we've talked about multiple times the importance of partners and just how powerful it is. You know, when Jobs started, he had Wozniak, and now he had Ives. We talk about Walt Disney and his brother Roy, and even with the Google guys. You know, when you have a partner, which makes me think about my current businesses, but whatever, I've got a wife who's my partner. And but the point is, when you've got someone who's got your back, who is also enthusiastic and supportive, you'll find that things suddenly move really, really fast. And what's a little concerning is we haven't heard her talk about that piece of it yet. You know, who's the other name within Yahoo who gets the vision and is helping to push her helping to push Yahoo forward? I think once you get that, and if I were her and that person already exists, wow, just that combination of the EX is bad for me this morning. when she finds that person, or if they're already on board, she needs to elevate them and get them out there. And not necessarily say you're the same level as me, but be like, this person just as important to the success of the company as I am. And I think you'll start to move stuff going forward, because you get the whole, you know, validation from, you know, from other people, and like, hey, there's at least one other person who thinks this. There was a cool TED talk. It probably was like 2 years ago now. But it was this idea of one of the greatest leaders is the first follower. And this guy, he analyzed that video of that guy who was, he was at a concert dancing on the hill, just like, you know, the crazy dance all by himself. And someone was videotaping it. And he goes for a while, like an awkwardly amount of time, where it's just him dancing really awkwardly, but like vigorous dancing. And then all of a sudden, some other dude jumps up and starts dancing with him just as bad and awkward, but now there's two of them. And now all of a sudden, and it was talking about this idea of movements and how the movements get created. And then what happened, you know, you watch more people join, and you know, then there's 10, and now it's like, okay, it's no longer weird. Now you can be kind of anonymous and get in on it, and you're still early on. And then all of a sudden, you know, like 100 people join, and he goes, and then it makes a tipping point where now you're the weirdo to be sitting down watching. You know, you need to get in on it. And his whole point was like, okay, yeah, that initial person who comes up with the idea and starts that track, yes, is critically important, you know, and obviously you have to have that. But that second person, that first follower, like that's where magic happens. And that's when, you know, things really start to move and really start to take off. And again, my concern for her is I don't know who that first follower is yet.
Right. I agree with you. It was nicely put. This is actually apropos of this. I'll throw it in. But that's actually one of my favorite reasons. It was one of my favorite parts about the show Lost, is that they had like, did you ever watch that show?
No.
So there's like four main characters. There's Jack, Sawyer, John Locke, and Kate. And so there's, and Jack is like,
and then Sawyer, right? Not Jack Sawyer.
Yeah, there's Jack, there's Sawyer, okay. There's John Locke, and Kate.
You're just getting me because you listed five names, so it was like, man, I got you. Three people,
right? They call him Locke, so it's Sawyer, okay. Locke, right. Jack, and Kate. Jack is like the leader of the survivalists. Sawyer is sort of this like bad boy. I survived, but I'm too cool for school. Sort of. Jack is the one with the conch shell. Sawyer's the one without the conch shell. And then John Locke is sort of this, like, almost mystic, like, he's a real wild card. And then, and they're always trying to convince people to go do stuff, whether it's, you know, we need to go this way, we need to do this. And they all have very, very different motives and very different and desires. Or even if they're all agreed about our goal is to survive, how to go about that, they think very differently. And so Kate's character actually ends up being the needle on the compass. Whoever she decides has the best idea is the one that wins. That's what everybody does. And I always thought that that was a really interesting character. You know, when you talk about, you know, character archetypes, I've always been a big believer that, you know, a lot of times character studies talk about individual characters, but I think that the dynamic of different characters is of multiple characters is its own archetype in and of itself. And I thought it was a really fascinating one because it was all about, she was the first follower. She very rarely led. She almost never came up with her own plan. It was always, her character was always bouncing around the other three, seeing who had the best idea, and then would follow them. And wherever she went, that was the direction that the entire island went. And so she ended up being the most important character for them to get on board. And of course, because she's a chick, there's got to be love triangles in the whole thing.
Naturally.
But, you know, and that added to the drama, because not always was the best idea the one that won. Sometimes it was the dude she was making out with at the time.
It happens.
But... no, it's terrible. But I always thought that that was a... So this is as we randomly plug TV shows and movies. I always thought that was the best part of Lost. Was that just that character dynamic? Oh, we have to go back. And that was for people who watched the show. But
I assume that because I had no idea what that meant. That's right. Yeah. I made a Captain reference earlier, so it's all good.
Oh, that's all right. You know. Hey man, this is what we do. This show is actually just a big advertising campaign for various movies and TV shows.
Yeah, we're actually making a ton of money off of this podcast because of all of our promos. Exactly. It's all in-ad advertising, which is the best kind, as we all know.
Exactly. We really should be getting paid for this.
Native advertising.
But yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. No. So she, right? I mean, you obviously read the article. I have not. Right? Do they talk about her?
They do talk
two?
About the other characters, and I probably should go through and read it again and pay more attention to that, because you're absolutely right. But they do talk about her building up a team, but it's definitely something from a marketing perspective. They have to do a better job of selling that when they're selling the idea of the company and their product portfolio, and they're trying to convince users that, hey, Yahoo's coming out with a new product, you should check it out, it's worth it, you know, because you got to turn around the image of the company as much as anything.
You could have some amazing Tumblr commercials that just seems ripe to be awesome. And I'm not talking about just like
YouTube.
What
I said, put them on Yahoo. I mean, YouTube.
Yeah, well, that too. And I guess I'm not just talking about video commercials. You know, I think there's some interesting, like, story-type things that they could do using Tumblr. I don't know. To me, that is a property that you... I mean, I know they promised they weren't going to change it or anything like that, but, geez, you could promote the jeebies out of it. And I think you can get super creative with it because of what it allows. And they don't for some reason. Or maybe they do, and I just don't watch television. That's also highly possible. But I don't think they do. Problem is, all their money is tied up in Alibaba.
Commercials.
Because there was an interesting article that was talking about Medium and their native advertising. And how they've got these different sections. They start up a new one called Gone. And it's all about travel. And it's sponsored by Marriott, and there are of these 60 articles they're going to write in the next, I forget what it was, it's like 90 days or something. It's a pretty fast clip. Five of them were like literally commercials. Like, for example, the very first one is talking about a new hotel that Marriott just opened up in Haiti. And it tells the story of how it was built, and you know, it takes that, you know, you obviously try to make it interesting, more documentary style thing, but you get to the end of it and it's like, do you want to go visit it now? Want to go stay there? You know, and it's done in a very natural way. And that's how Medium is making money. That's just getting Marriott's paid them, I'm guessing, a ton of money to create this section called Gone. And it's like, dude, you could have some Tumblr blogs. That's what they are. And you know, these are ad type things, and you're doing some cool stuff that people actually want to check out. And I think Tumblr needs to work on their content discovery a little bit, like Medium does. But I don't know. I feel like they've got something magical there, and they're not taking advantage of it yet.
I agree. But
they got the whole news thing, too, that I don't... That's another one that feels like it should be really good, where they're hiring all of these journalists, and it... again, maybe it's too early. You know, I know HP's got like a 3-year product cycle. You come up with an idea. Well, it's more like 7 years, right? You come up with some idea, you iterate it for a while, and then you do some concept design and testing, and then it's like to the point where you're like, you know what? I think we have something we can make.
Yeah.
Then it's a 3-year timer, and it takes 3 years to get that thing out to market, to do the final design stuff, to actually test beta models and all that stuff, to get the marketing engine going before you're like, okay, time to release. And I get that that's a physical product, but yeah, and sure, coding mobile apps and stuff like that should not take as long because they're a lot easier to test. They're inherently not as complicated.
Yeah. But
still, you know, it takes a year or two to do it right, especially if a company that size. And so, I don't know. And you're not going to do little piddly things either. You're going to swing for the big stuff. Let's tackle a hard problem that everyone else is afraid of because we have the resources.
Right.
So, you know, that takes time. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's definitely interesting. It's a fascinating.
It's one of those where, if she doesn't get that number two or change the culture or something, yeah, they'll just get bought by someone eventually. It'll be an offer that they'll be like, wow. I don't know who would be interested in buying them, other than you get someone else who comes along and is like, dude, I've got some ideas, and I didn't make the promise to Tumblr not to keep them, not touch them. Yeah, my opinion.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I just don't know who would buy them. Google's not going to. They don't need them. They've got Blogger for their Tumblr competitor.
I think it would be AOL or something like that, a similar sized company that can finance the whole, that can find somebody to finance them. It would be a smaller company. It would be more of a merger type deal, and it would be financed by the giant banks.
Right. Yeah, I guess AOL would be, they're on that content kick.
Yeah. Perhaps. I don't make any money from it, but hey.
Can you imagine TechCrunch using Tumblr instead of WordPress? Oh, man.
Oh, geez.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah.
Huffington Post on Tumblr? What? Oh. Love it.
So we got about a half an hour left. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Really? Jeez. Yeah. Well, we blew that, didn't we?
Oh, that's all right. Let's just, let's check out the rest of the news. There's other stuff that's going on.
All right. Well, I can do... I've got... I'm going to let you do a few, and then I'll jump in.
All right. So what is the definition of classic, James? Do you know off the top of your head?
Classic. It is something that is old and but revered, potentially. Maybe original. Like it was the first one of something.
Okay, all right. So I looked up the dictionary definition of classic just so I could be really sure, because sometimes general accepted meanings shift over time, but there's usually a foundational specific meaning. And so classic, as an adjective, so descriptive word, is something that has been judged over a period of time to be of the highest quality and outstanding of its kind.
Ah.
So BlackBerry...
Over a period of time. I feel like that part is critically important.
Yeah, and also outstanding, highest quality. So BlackBerry has announced that they are having a classic throwback. Yeah, so basically what they're doing is they're launching a BlackBerry that the hardware looks just like one of their older BlackBerries. Ugly.
But with the new operating system.
BlackBerry's, quote, classic. And this is the important reason why there's quotes everywhere around classic. Phone is a curious bit of fan service, a seemingly conciliatory blend of old and new design. to appeal to Waterloo's diehards, which are who? It might seem a little odd that the company
finance
who,
people.
Yeah. Company who chose to, or it might seem a little odd that the company chose to go all retro on us in 2014, but there's no denying the formula still has some appeal. Is there no denying of that? so basically what it is a smaller phone. It's running the new software. It's got the keyboard. I just have a hard time throwing around the word, the dictionary defined word classic on this style of phone.
Well, at one point in time, it was the highest selling, most popular phone out there. And if we were defining classic and highest quality as best selling, which they are, okay. But there is a reason why this style was very quickly
highest quality.
Well, I don't want to describe this. Like, you look at a classic car, and you're like, for its time, you're like, very well built, very pretty. You know, if you think about some of those old, what are they called? Corvettes, you know, especially in the late 60s. Those are classics.
But this is the Klee. They're classic because they're still beautiful cars.
Yes, very true. Well, and part of where I was headed to is when you compare a 1968 Corvette versus a 2014 Corvette, it's an evolutionary change between the two. You know, styles are still very similar, you know, ish. I'm glad they made the back end smaller now, because what they were doing in the 2000s was just bad. But, and we have exhausted the extent of my car knowledge. But, there you can clearly see how they got from point A to point B when you're comparing those two car models. And you can appreciate, and it's still even, I would argue, functional to drive around a 1968 Corvette. The problem that BlackBerry is running into is that in, what was it, 2004? Or was it 2007? I can't remember now. I feel it must have been 2007. It was not an evolutionary step.
Yes.
You cannot look at this BlackBerry and go, how did it get to the new one? I mean, you go, well, there's no more keyboard. That's not just it.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to it. And so it's one of those where it was like going, it's the equivalent of saying, wow, dude, that is a classic buggy right there. That's amazing. Like, no.
Yeah. Which nobody would ever say. I mean,
yeah, you would look at it and touch it and maybe do a fun little ride around in it, but you're not going to go buy one.
Exactly. 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 Exactly.
Well, you know, they'll sell half a dozen of them. It'll be good for them.
They will. But this is actually, so this is the other real thing that I thought was, this is awesome in context of this show. sort of, but it brings how BlackBerry is surviving, and the idea is that BlackBerry is surviving, but not as a smartphone company, which kind of explains this decision. Basically, what they're saying is that in the Canadian outfit's last 3 months report, it revealed that losses have been trimmed from $4.4 billion last year to a much more manageable $148 million. Of course,
hey, good job.
As the business reinvents itself. We're going to be I can't remember what we predicted on this one. I'm hoping we said it would make it through 2015 cuz yay. But I can't remember what we predicted.
I can't remember, of course,
it's clear as the business reinvents itself as a software and service company, software as a service company, manufacturing smartphones has increasingly become a side project. At this point last year, the company shipped 4.3 million smartphones, although the bulk of those were older BlackBerry 7 devices. This time around, less than half that figure, 1.9 million devices, found their way into the hands of consumers, with sales dwindling even in former strongholds. And And so,
well, that's why they came up with the classic. It didn't make sense to do the R&D for a new device, so they just went, "Well, what did we do 10 years ago? Let's redo that one."
Yep, using old mold, literally.
They had for it. Yeah, done. This is an easy story. I see what happened there.
Yeah.
Smart on their behalf, yep. You know? It's dying. Why invest in it? Let's just use an old school style. Because I remember correctly, the chip they're using is from like 2012, too. It's even an older chip. They're like, it's not that great. I mean, you know, you could do email, but you're not going to be using any of the new apps.
Why? Yeah, because what apps, James? They don't have any.
Well, they've got access to the Android store via the Amazon Marketplace, but it's still, it's like, because of the old processor, you're not going to download anything.
That's true.
Really. Nah.
So they're selling software as a service.
I didn't know their sales were that small. Less than 2 million. Jeez.
Yeah.
That's less than 1% of the market, for those of you keeping score, which someone once said is an important metric.
It is a very important metric.
In around 2007.
Yeah. They're, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens to BlackBerry over the next year, but they're clearly managing to survive. It's funny. One of the things that I keep coming back to is if it weren't for the historical context of this company, we wouldn't even know who they are. I mean, they are nobody. They're a tiny little gnat of a company nowadays. And, you know, that's the only, but they're, you know, but it's fun to watch because you're just like, you know, it's fun to watch. It'll be interesting to see how they do it and to see what comes of them over the next couple of years. But yeah, I agree with you completely. That was kind of my take on my general conclusion on what happened there. With the first story first so I could make fun of them, but it wasn't a terrible idea.
Fair enough. I use an app daily called Lyft. I might have talked about it a couple times on the podcast. It's an app where you set daily goals, and as you do them, you check them off. It's pretty straightforward. So, like, for example, one of my goals is to floss every day.
Nice.
And I'm opening it up right now just so I can see how I've done, which I have not done today yet, which is sad.
Disgusting.
But I have my streak right now. I have flossed 704 days in a row.
Whoa. That's
kinda
a lot
cool,
of
right?
rows.
And I take it when I go to my dentist, I go, look, I've been flossing. Here's proof.
Here's proof.
Well, and then they look at my gums and teeth and they go, you are right. And office visits are a lot more fun now. So you can set quotes, and if you pull down, it even has a daily quote. What did I say? Goals. It has quotes, too. For example, today it says, Benjamin Franklin said, well done is better than well said.
That is deep.
He's dropping some. I'm going to...
Wisdom.
I'm going to actually email that to myself real quick, because that's a good... Because what I do, fun fact inside the life of James Furlow, whenever I share... why is this thing not being complete? Whenever I share data at work, Ben quoted that works. I include a quote with my output.
Nice,
because I'm that guy. But the point being, you can track stuff that you're doing, and it'll tell you about your streaks. You can also write a little comment with it, like, "Wow, that was a really hard workout today, but I did my workout today." Or, you know, I ran up 10 hills or however many miles you ran or something. And then other people sign up for similar goals and they can kind of like give you props, kind of like a high five. Hey, good job. And so it's a fun app. Like I said, I've been using it. None of my friends are, but that's okay. I'll
You need your first follower.
I know. I thought I had him too. And then he dropped off. I was like, man,
happens.
They are today they're expanding what they're doing. They're now Lyft 2.0, and I've known about it for a while because I'm a Lyft insider because I'm cool like that. They invited special people who have abnormally long streaks to participate. I've got a couple of those. So I like my routine. Okay, it's all right.
Do they have a widget yet? They should have a widget.
Yeah, I think they do. I think they do.
Because a widget would be nice.
Widgets are dumb, but okay.
They are dumb, but it's kind of fun to say.
Okay.
I have a widget.
That's great. I have yet to find one that actually makes sense. Anyways, they've got just over 1 million people and using it, which is pretty cool. But what they're now doing is they're bringing coaches. Because it's one thing to say hey, you know what, I'm tracking it myself, and every once in a while someone will say hey, good job for reaching that goal. Another to say, I'm paying $15 a week to ask questions and get encouragement from a coach, an expert, who's simply defined as someone who has done what you're looking to do. And so they can help you with it. And so they've got 700 coaches that are trained to help out with 4,000 goals. And they're kind of $15 a week. That might sound like a lot, but normally personal coaches, they could be $1,000 a week.
Right.
So we're actually pretty reasonable. And he goes, these are really for difficult types of goals to do. Weight loss being one of them. You may want to do something to improve your career or something like that. He's like, these are trickier ones, not just mind flossing. He's like, it's pretty easy. You don't need a coach for that. Though, if you want to give me $15, I'll chat it up with you and we'll talk about flossing. I'm like, yeah, I guess. And then they've got ideas on how to integrate phone calls and even video stuff later on for obviously more money. But pretty cool app that's doing really, really well. My mini claim to fame is that the CEO, Tony Stumblebine, I don't know. My very first interaction with him was, one of my goals is to save money each day, to figure out a way to save money. And so when I first did that goal, I turned off the heat in the house and threw on a bunch of, jackets and stuff like that. I was like, all right, I'm saving money. Woohoo.
That is awful.
Yeah, I know. And, Vinny hated it because he was like, why you turned the heater off, bud?
Yeah, it's cold in here. You know that, right?
yeah. Well, and so you can, when you achieve the goal, it gives you an option to share it. And so I did on Twitter, and it was save money, what am I thinking of? Task or goal or whatever achieved for the day. And then you have an option again to leave a comment. And I was turned heater off to, in order to save money. My dog hates me now. And so that was what I tweeted out. He replied back to me and was like, no props. Lyft is a pro dog company. It's like, yes. I'm like, that's cool. All right. Customer for life. Good job. And anyways, they're kicking butt, taking names, doing really well. Fun fact, they are part of the Obvious Corp incubator. So they were incubated inside of Twitter. And so, pretty cool. They're doing well.
That's cool. I'll check that out.
They get deep. I can't guarantee
I'll be your first follower, but right. I'll download it just to. You've talked me into it. It's free, right? I mean, or yeah, it's yeah. Git.
It's very free.
Cool. So my app, or do you want to go again?
We'll jump back and forth.
I'll go. So this is hilarious. Tag Heuer is one of your Swiss watch manufacturers. They make fancy watches.
Yeah. They make clothes too, right? Or they just do watches?
They do all sorts of stuff, but their watches are
they're fancy smancy.
Yeah, their watches are their big thing. Very, very expensive. Nice watches. Not I was about to say not Rolexes, but they'd probably slap me for saying that. But right when the Apple Watch was announced, there was this big all the Swiss everybody went to the Swiss manufacturer. What do you think now?
I remember that. It was pretty funny.
And the Swiss watchmakers were like, psh, whatever, Apple's got nothing on us. They're not going to, these computer manufacturers aren't going to come in here and you know, and beat us at something we've been doing for 10 years, said BlackBerry 8 years ago. That was just that is one of the greatest quotes of all time. Just, hubris at its best. But the watch corporations basically said the same thing. And they said it with, it wasn't quite as like, wow, you just set yourself up for one of the greatest collapses of all time. But at the same time, it's like, it's same ballpark. Anyways, Tag Heuer basically came out this week and said, hey, we're working on a smartwatch. It's going to be awesome. And, you know, which I think is smart. There's enough evidence that there's some real movements going on. You know, Pebble's selling well. You know, all of your big mobile electronics companies are coming out with some sort of a watch. Android Wear is really kicking butt. Pebble is starting to grab push notifications from Android Wear software. Like, there's all sorts of things that are going on in the market right now that show at least me that there's, you know, there's potential there. And obviously the Apple Watch is impending. You know, I expect those to sell well as well, and as I will be buying one. But the best part about this is that when they asked them, so how long have you been working on this Apple Watch? They said, I don't know, about 4 months. That was about 3.5 months after the Apple Watch was announced.
Nice.
You know, it's just... It's one of those, like, you know, if you're going to come out day after the watch is announced and say, no, it's a terrible idea, it'll never sell. But in the, you know, back room, talk to, like, and whispering to everybody, oh my gosh, the worst thing just happened to us. It looks awesome. You know, it shows that, you know, even Steve Jobs was legendary for saying that books are dead. Nobody will ever read again. 6 months before they launched Apple Books, like,
or iBooks. Yeah, but the funny part about that is, like, Apple had been working on it for a year or two when he made that comment. And you're just like, oh, Steve, you can't be trusted.
Oh yeah. Whereas, well, but I mean,
these guys,
I guess
they literally,
in general,
so far they haven't given any double talk. They're literally saying what they believe and. Because they genuinely believed it when they said it at the time, whereas for him, he was putting on a show.
That's true. Yeah. Well, yeah. But it's I don't know. It's hilarious that it's like at least somebody in the company realized that moment that there is a chance. And I would guess.
Hey, at least they realized it now instead of BlackBerry, who waited until their sales started crumbling.
Yeah. 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 I have a feeling that what ended up happening was they finally actually got to see them, and they decided that somebody with some level of sense in the company sat there and went, you know, these aren't ugly. You know, we were expecting them to be made out of aluminum and cost less than $500, but they're made out of, you know, solid rose gold, and they're going to cost $10,000. These are going to sell for that reason alone, and it's stupid, but, you know, if we want to compete against them, we're going to have to compete against them, and we're going to have to offer something that at least is in the same ballpark of an offering.
Well, yeah, and where you struggle with stuff like that is, you know, they're not selling millions of them a year. They're selling hundreds of thousands of them a year. And they went, Apple's going to pick off 10% of our customers, and that's where we make all of our profit.
Right. That's the last. That is the, yeah, exactly. And it's a problem for them, and they've got to deal with it. And, yeah, you know, that's a great point, is it's not like Apple has to steal all their customers in order to ruin these companies. It's just that only a couple of those the watchmakers are going to survive. Not many, because there's just a lot of competition and for beautiful mechanical watches. And all Apple has to do is suck out, like you said, 10% of the dollars out of the market, and that will cause 50% of the watchmakers to collapse. Like
I mean, I look at this picture here of I'm guessing he's the CEO. Yes, he is. Or interim CEO. It's a picture of his office, and it's very cool. And when you look in the back behind him, that is a nice room.
And I just look at that and go, okay, yes, Apple's making a ginormous spaceship. I get it. But these are not lean, mean little companies that just happen to make premium, amazing products. Their overhead and costs have got to be huge. And it's going to put, and these are, I mean, we're talking about people who like to buy luxury goods. Shocker that their offices are luxury offices, you know, and that's part of what they try to exude. You know, we're all about luxury here. And so, like I said, 10% cut is going to, that's going to be tough, you know, and they're going to be like, we're competing against guys who run around in jeans and t-shirts and, you know, and they've got this entirely other product line over here that is funding all of their fun. And they're, instead of buying, again, yes, I get it, they're making a spaceship, but instead of, you know, filling it with luxury items, they're filling it with the highest tech research and development they can to compete against us.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're doing it to say, we're going to get everyone in the same location, and we're going to innovate faster and better than ever before. And I don't know. There's not a lot going for them.
Yeah, and it's and like you said, it's Apple doesn't have to win, and that's their biggest problem is that Apple does not have to win in order to crush your company, which means that I do believe that there's going to be space for watchmakers in the future, but part of your lineup is going to have to be something to compete. You have to offer something better than the other watchmakers. You have to legitimately the competition. There's going to be less dollars spread around the Swiss watchmakers. If their margins are small enough, that's a huge problem. Only a few are going to survive, and as a result, that means you just have to up your competition. So I would see this as not even necessarily a move to compete and beat Apple, because they're not really competing against Apple to some degree. They're competing, they just want to sell one more watch than the other guy, than the other Swiss watchmaker. And you know, at least over the next 5 years, that's their strategy, I think. And I would agree that it's not a terrible strategy, because I think you're 10 years out from mechanical watches being just a real super luxury good.
And see, that's the issue that they've got to keep in mind, is this is the first iteration of it, and they shouldn't be worried about this one. They should be worried about the watch that comes out in 3 and 4 years from now.
They should be worried about the watch that I keep predicting, which is the internet connected watch. Not a lot of bandwidth, not a lot of speed. It's got a good battery life. It lasts, you know, an 8-day battery life with a 3G web connection for notifications and simple communications. That is a terrifying device. To anybody who doesn't understand what that is, what that means, and the implications of that, really needs to sit and think long and hard about what it means to be able to walk away from your smartphone for good, and what that would mean to the market in general, what that would mean to smartphone manufacturers, what that means to people who wear stuff on their wrists. The idea that you could walk away from your smartphone for good, and this is a reliable option, as long as you have an internet-connected iPad somewhere around you in the next room in your car, you know, as long as you have computers around you but your persistent connection is on your wrist, and 10 years from now, that could very well be what they're launching. And at that point, now you're competing for risk space, not just dollars. And that's where it becomes a disaster for the Swiss watchmakers, because you'd have to walk away from your internet connection in order to, or have two watches, which is just not very stylish. you know, I don't know. It's an interesting problem. It's a very interesting problem that they deal with.
I agree.
I think it's good that Tag Heuer is at least acknowledged the fact that maybe we should come out with something that competes. I don't know.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea. Are you pumped about T-Mobile and their rollover data plans?
No, because it doesn't affect me at all.
Oh, because you're all unlimited and stuff?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
I mean, I didn't mean to take all the air out of this conversation, but
no, that's cool. They are doing a very good job of getting me to go, I should look into T-Mobile.
Yeah.
I think if I remember, when Dad came up, he had T-Mobile at the time. I think it all worked fine. I don't think he had any problems using it.
Man, he doesn't really use data, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They're just making some very compelling cases. The $100 four-person family plan, and now with rollover data, that's pretty reasonable. I'm like, I don't know what it takes to switch, but so I've got a contract, obviously. Yeah. They continue to do things where you go, geez, is AT&T worth it?
No.
I don't know. I like what they're doing.
I would agree. They're competing about as hard as you possibly could.
The $100 for four people. I mean, that's right up there with, Republic Wireless rates.
Yeah. Well, and I sit down and I go there.
Yes.
The $100 for two people is incredibly compelling. I mean,
that's
for
true.
Me, you yeah, know, yeah. And unlimited everything for two people. I mean, come on, that's pretty. I actually don't know what the international deal is on that. I'd have to look into that because that might actually be how they pulled that $30 off. Because and that's worth $30 to me. I wouldn't be able to walk away from the plan I have currently if it didn't come with international data and stuff, because I'm going to England at the end of January and I don't want to be without internet, which England is remarkably arcane in their internet infrastructure. Come on, guys. You are a modernized Western culture. Like, get your Wi-Fi act together, okay? But...
Yeah, no, they keep... I don't know. At first I was like, I want to switch over to the AT&T data buckets thing because you could tether and stuff, and that sounds cool to me. But the more and more it's like, geez, if I'm going to make a move, T-Mobile might be the way to do it. I mean, I get you got to pay for your device up front, and that's, you know.
But overall lifetime of the cost, it's, you know.
Oh, I know. I am fully aware of, because right now there's four of us, and we're paying just over $200 a month, and that's after my HP discount. It's like we're paying $220 a month. Yeah, exactly. And I think it would be close to like $250 a month if I didn't have that. And so I'm like, geez, I'm spending an extra, what is it? We're paying $50 a person, right?
Yeah.
So I'm spending an extra $50 a month for the convenience of not moving and to not have tethering and other stuff. That doesn't seem like a wise choice.
I would agree.
maybe this week. We should just
I didn't add this story, good. But what?
They're doing good. I like what they're doing. You've caught my attention, Timo.
I didn't add this story, but they just announced that in some boroughs in New York, they're offering 100 megabyte per second LTE.
Wow,
that's astounding, James. That's out of this world speed. I mean, it doesn't even affect me, but it might one day soon. I could watch a lot of YouTube with that. You know what is driving me nuts though? This is driving me crazy. My iPhone 5. it crashed significantly fewer times this week than it did last week, which was nice. It's definitely, we are fully into end of the life cycle on this device, and it is going to be a test to see how long I can put up with this. But I keep having to remind myself how expensive the Apple Watch is going to be, how expensive it's going to be. But the fact that I've been working on my savings so that I'll have more money to spend on things, which is it's one of those like weird,
that's counterintuitive. That's not called savings. That's called delayed spending. There's a difference.
But what is, I mean, yes, I agree. But it's like, what is the point of saving if you're not going to spend it eventually? Isn't all savings delayed spending?
No. The point of saving is to buy assets. So then you could spend the assets money, not your savings.
Okay.
It's a subtle difference.
Well, see, I've got no assets I'm trying to buy right now. I guess
that's your problem.
Yeah, so, but you know, it's like...
Enjoy the middle class, sucker.
You what?
I said enjoy the middle class, sucker.
Hey, I am by definition upper class.
Upper class?
Upper class. By I'm the very bottom of the upper class, but I made the cut.
How? Whose scale are we referring to here?
Wikipedia's.
Oh yeah.
Come on. Yeah, Wikipedia. What is this? Because one of our uncles made a comment. My cousin and I were talking about the fact that we're like kind of middle class, whatever. And my uncle's like, "You guys are upper class." We're like, "What?" And he's like, "You guys are easily defined as upper class. Like, it's ridiculous that you wouldn't think that you are." I'm like, "Whatever." So I looked it up, but yeah, totally fit the dictionary or the Wikipedia definition.
Is it solely based off of an income amount?
Man, it's a couple of different factors. Income's the biggest requirement, but it's also your relationship status. It's the fact that I'm a single male. It allows me to be.
All right. How do we do this? Wikipedia. What do I search for?
I just did upper class.
Wikipedia upper class. Here we go. But first, a word from our sponsor. Please sign up. There it is. Dear readers, you get it. We'll get right to it. They need $15. Did you donate?
I donate every year, and I haven't yet, though.
Okay. Let's see here. Where is... where's the definition of it? In modern societies, is the social class composed of the wealthiest members of society who also wield the greatest political power. According to this view, the upper class is generally contained within the wealthiest 1 to 2% of the population. You must be doing
this
very well.
I'm going to be honest with you, James. It took me a little while to find the actual definition.
You must have immense wealth, because that's one of the definitions. Ooh, in the form of estates. Interesting. Was it passed from generation to generation? That's an unreliable source, I guess. Let's see here. This definition is at odds, though, with how the upper class views itself. As members of families that have been long distinguished, not merely by wealth or fame, which are ostensibly available to all other demographic society, but rather by generations of leadership and public service, education, charity, the military, and the arts.
See?
Dude, you're not upper class, according to this, unless you're doing very well that I am not aware of. And you're in the wealthiest 1 to 2% of the population. This is Wikipedia upper class.
Oh. American upper class? Because it changes.
Ah, jeez. In the United States, the upper class, as distinguished from the rich, is often considered to consist of those families that have, for many generations, enjoyed top social status based on their leadership in society and their distinctive cultural derived from their upper class ancestors in a colonial gentry.
I'm gonna let you in on a little secret that I don't tell everybody who does this, because most people don't challenge it. But there's not actually a definition of the upper class. There's like 7,000 different ones. So I picked one that I fit into and just forgot where I found it and went, sure.
Why would you do that? Because that doesn't bolster your argument.
What?
You picked one that was like, you just, oh, okay, I got you. Well, I said, I don't understand why. When your original argument was, I'm not, you picked one that gave you the yes. And I figured out why. It's because you want to be able to say it.
Yeah, exactly. Because
I would argue though, since it is counterintuitive to make that statement, you may want to remember that source and the reason why.
Well, you know, people like you, I'll just tell the honest truth to, because then you'll be like, ah, okay, I get the game we're playing. And then,
okay.
Whereas other people, it's sort of a test of sorts. Most people, you just say I Wikipedia'd it, and they're like, okay.
Works for me.
That's
what's great about Wikipedia. It's not the fact that it's on there. It's the fact that all you have to do is reference it, and it's believed to be true. That you referenced it correctly, which is the funny part, and what drives teachers crazy. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think you're still up, dude, because I don't think you actually did a story. You just referred to yourself.
Okay, right? You're absolutely right. We got to move pretty quick. So have you ever, I'm not going to do this. Well, so Have you ever?
Maybe.
Dude lost both his arms. I don't remember.
I've never lost both my arms. I can say
this I changed stories, James.
Okay.
get back on the rails. guy lost both his arms, and they talk about it in the video. They probably write it down in the article. I can't remember why, but it was like an accident thing. He's a double amputee at the shoulder. So they're working with automated prosthetics that read your muscle movements and stuff. So they built this dude these prosthetic mechanical arms that read muscle movements and nerve endings in his chest to sort of allow him to communicate with the arms. And they work. It's crazy. Boom. He can like manipulate stuff. The guy's armless, and he's got two robotic arms that he's controlling with his brain. It's really exciting. obviously, this is still in what you would call probably the alpha stage of development, but it's...
Yeah.
Did
they let him take it home?
Can he bring it home? Is that what he
is? Yeah, like, did he take him home, and is he using it, like, that kind of... Or they just threw him on him temporarily?
He did for this video. This was like the first major show of it, and they still have work to do. But their goal is to by the end of 2015 to have him at home working with them, like using them regularly.
That's pretty cool.
It's freaking amazing. It's awesome. And he said it was pretty funny because like one of the things that they ran into is like they had to make this like body cast for him, so they did a 3D. A 3D projection of him, or they took a 3D scan of him and then like printed this thing out, and it felt too good. He couldn't really feel it, so they had to like remake it so that
that's
like,
weird.
Yeah,
I mean, it's so cool.
They had to change the fit so that it was more comfortable, so it actually felt like it was on him. But yeah,
that's
they mount
so
these
weird.
Mechanical...
It fits so well. I don't think it's on me. That's where you want it to be. I think you'd be like, don't worry about it. You'll be used to it.
Yeah, I would say that too, but. But yeah, then they strap these mechanical arms to it with like fully articulatable fingers and arms and stuff, and hooked him up to a bunch of anode cathode type things to sense his body, and he's controlling the arms with his brain pan. It's amazing.
Sweet.
I'm so excited about the future, because I've long stated I'm not like into tattoos and all. You know, I mean, whatever. If you got tattoos, it's cool. I don't have anything against tattoos at all. But, like, I've just never seen anything that, like, really compelled me. But I'm totally all up for the cybernetic body, you know, modification, like, whatever. I see those as parallel body modification style things. And, like, I am super excited about getting extra arms and bionic eyeballs and super hearing and stuff like that. And so every time I see one of these things, I'm like, yes! We will be able to do it in my lifetime. I've long said if I were to lose my leg, my left leg under my knee, despite the pain that I would presumably be feeling, totally wouldn't be bummed about it. Be like, as soon as the pain was gone, I'm over it. Get me a prosthetic. I'm ready, man. I'm ready to become a robot. Like, that's... Like, if I lost it above the knee, it's a little more complicated. The prosthetics become considerably more expensive, and they're not quite as far along. Still okay with it, though. Right leg, right leg's a little more complicated because that's my dominant leg, and I do a lot more with it. But still, I would miss it. But, like, literally, it would not trouble me in the least if I lost my left leg under my knee. Like, I wouldn't even bother me. Just whatever. Okay, I can deal with it. Bring
well,
on the cool Halloween
in
costumes.
In life. Wow. All right.
But
that's a pretty funny.
This sort of thing gets me pretty excited.
Okay. Something that gets me excited is flying airplanes. I genuinely enjoy it. For those of you who also do enjoy it, you can do it now. X-Plane has come out with a new iOS app for flying airplanes. It's cool. The app itself is actually free, which is an improvement over their previous one where you had to pay for it. You get a little Cessna for free in the free flight, and then if you want to buy some other cooler planes, you can. or they have there's, like I said, there's the free flight where you just fly, which is pretty much all I've done. But then they also have like flight training where they're like, here are the basic controls of an airplane. Here's how to take off. Here's how to land. Here's how to do different routes. Here's how to land a Boeing 737. Or no, it's an Airbus. Sorry, guys. My bad. and then I realized that was like me mixing up Windows and Apple. Can't do that. And then they also have some fighter jets as well, so you can practice your dogfighting skills and like bombing targets. And so they have like training modules that you can go through. And then they also have challenges where it's like, okay, you gotta land in bad weather, or you gotta go through these, you gotta fly, you know, through different terrains, you know, racing, that kind of stuff. So pretty, you know, pretty big app from that perspective. And from what I can tell, highly accurate. And in the weather conditions, like this morning, I took off in SeaTac, and I had it. So I took off in the middle of a storm, and there was some wind involved too. And obviously, the clouds were there, and it was a pretty wild ride. I think I crashed that one. I don't think I landed safely, but it was fun. I took off, and I got up. And at about 5,000 feet, got above the clouds, and all of a sudden it was, you know, nice and pretty, and everything was fine, and the wind dies down, right? And you're like, oh, okay, this is cool, as it should be. And then you go back down into the clouds, and you can't see anything. It's just gray. You're like, man. And you're watching it slowly tick down, get closer to the ground. You're like, I really hope this breaks up pretty soon, because I can't see a thing. And around 2,000 feet, it suddenly does. And I'm like, okay, now I got to find the airport, because I've totally lost my way. At one point in time, I was like flying upside down and just totally, you know, just disoriented. And like, man, if this was real life, I'd be dead right now. Just passed out of my seat, tumbling towards the ground. But pretty fun game. Just check it out.
That was very cool.
I love those flight simulators.
You were all about the games, man. And then my last, I will do this story. This will be my last one, though. So driving down, have you ever stopped at Harris Ranch?
Harris Ranch. Yeah. Not that I recall, but maybe. Where is it located?
As you're driving down the 5 from Northern Central California to Southern California, as though you're going to Disneyland, you pass this place called Harris Ranch. And basically, Harris Ranch is this giant ranch with a bunch of cows on it. Across the street is this like hotel restaurant type place, and it's like it's kind of a fancier restaurant type place. It's so funny. Last time when I went for the half marathon earlier this year, I drove down with our cousin Timmy, and we decided to go there because what the heck, and deferred spending, and we got money.
upper class.
Exactly. And we stopped there, and we were like, whoa, there's a Tesla charging station there. It's funny, the more like you think about it, the more it makes sense, because you kind of got to have a lot of money to own a Tesla. If you're driving down, it's a nice restaurant, like it's a steak restaurant, and you plug your Tesla in and charge while you get a steak. And I'm like, okay, I get why they did this. It's coming together. It was so funny. We went in, and Timmy hadn't been there forever, and it was the first time I'd ever gone there. So we like went to the first place where you could stop and get food, like the first restaurant, not realizing it was the first restaurant. We just went to the first place. You go, oh, there's food here. So we like went in, and everything's like crazy expensive. We're like, what the heck? Like, and he was like, man, we used to go here with our grandparents, and like, I can't believe they were like dropping like $25 for a person before booze. This is crazy. This is like, it's amazing how expensive this is. And turns out afterwards I had to like go to the bathroom. I was like, where's the bathroom? And they're like, oh, it's down the hall next to the other restaurant. Turns out the other restaurant's a little more family friendly. It was delicious. I mean, it was like one of the best like steak sandwiches I'd ever had, but oh boy. And but anyways, the reason I bring all this up is because Tesla has announced that this week they're going to open up their first battery swap station for Teslas. And it happens to be halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles, which happens to be Harris Ranch. So this is like their first go at trying out this, you know, this scene. Demand, seeing practically how hard it is, how easy it is, stuff like that, and trying to sort out all the legal regalia of doing the battery swap stations. It's a cool technology. Yeah, it's obviously something that's been we've been excited about for a while. I probably wouldn't even mention it if I didn't have that fun anecdote to tell about Harris Ranch. But
right,
it was cool.
Cool. I love it. That's pretty funny. Final story, which again is another non-paid advertisement, but that's okay. I was introduced to a new game last night. So I actually went to watch the Hobbit movie with 12 people, including myself.
Which
Fandango's
pretty Make your
fun.
Own fellowship.
Oh, dude. We did. We went to a pizza place beforehand. So the movie was at 7:30. We met at 5:30. To have pizza and hang out and have fun before we all trekked over there. A bunch of high schoolers.
You got ring-shaped food with 12 people.
What?
You got a ring-shaped food with 12 people? You saw
Lord
of the Rings.
Well, the best part is we picked, like, Bilbo was one of our names for the order, you know?
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay.
Some fun. You got it. You got stuff. So, but all this to say, when you hang out with high schoolers, you often learn about new games. And so I learned about one last night. Pretty fun. It's called Circle the Dot. And, you literally, you start out with a screen. I'm going to see if I can describe it to you. Where you have a bunch of gray dots and then a blue dot and then a couple yellow dots. And your whole goal is to trap the blue dot so that it can't move anywhere. And the blue dot's goal is to get off the board. And so it's constantly moving towards the edge. And it can't move where there's an orange dot. It can only move where there's just gray dots. And as you tap on the screen, it fills it in with an orange dot. Highly addictive and fun.
All right. I'm downloading it right now. Check it out. It seems like the sort of thing I'd be into.
You can, it's very similar to your Minesweeper, very similar, but you feel like it's more like you're competing against the computer. And, and they definitely set it so that it's smart. You know, it's not going to do anything dumb and you go, I got it. You legitimately have to outthink. You have to pick the best way to beat it. It's fascinating. But just for those of you who like quick games that you can play, I can't promise you're going to like suddenly figure out how to win and win a lot, though I do find like you'll get on a streak where you win like 3 times in a row. Like, man, I'm so good. And then you get cocky and then you can't win again for like 10 minutes. But games last somewhere between, 15 seconds to 30 seconds. So you can get a lot of games in pretty quick. Like I said, you would enjoy it. So that's Circle the Dot for iOS.
All right.
Check it out.
Yeah, this is going to drive me nuts.
Yeah, it's a fun game. It's genuinely fun. So, let's see here. I think that's what I need to do. All right, everybody. We genuinely appreciate you joining us. That is our show. Did you win? No, you got beat. I can tell by your face.
I missed.
Oh, I hate that. I hate that. So, everybody, thank you for joining us. We really do appreciate it. Do not forget to check out the show notes at furloughbros.com to see all the links that we have posted there. It's a really good resource, especially checking out what happened previously in the year. My name is James Furlough. My brother, who is also a fan of Hobbits, is Matthew Furlough. And so we will talk next time.
Thank you.